13,879 days. That's the title of our message this morning. 13,879 days. Now, who thinks they know what that means? Who figured that out? And if you're in the first service, you can't talk, okay, because you know the answer to it. Anybody here think they figured out? What is the 13,879 days refer to? Okay, that's not it. But that was actually somebody in the first service said that as well. That was a good guess, but that's not it. 13,879 days. Anybody else? That is how many days the invalid in John chapter 5 was unable to walk. 13,879 days. The text says 38 years. But I was thinking about it the other day, and I was thinking about, and Kathy and I were talking, and I was thinking about this man, and I thought, you know what? When we study John chapter 5, we focus on one day in this man's life, don't we? We focus on the day he met Jesus, and that's great. What a great day that was for him. After 38 years of being paralyzed, 38 years of not being able to walk, 38 years of not being able to take himself anywhere, suddenly Jesus says, get up, take up your mat and walk. What a great day. But what about the 13,879 days in which he couldn't do that? That's a long time, isn't it? That's a long time to be enduring such a burden. It's a long time to be enduring such an illness, such a disease. It's a long time to be enduring that kind of difficulty in a person's life. And if there's anything that I think we should learn from this man... Now, understand, I want you to learn that Jesus is powerful. That's what John wants us to learn. I want you to understand that John is presenting evidence that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, God incarnate. I want you to understand that. I want you to understand that Jesus, throughout this book, John will show us that he has power over nature. He has power over matter. He has power over disease. He has power over death. We're going to see that. And I want you to learn that. I want you to understand that. But I want you also to see, and I want to see from a illustration like this man's life, 13,879 days before he encountered Jesus. And so I want us to see and I want us to understand that it's always too soon to quit. It's always too soon to quit. It's always too soon to give up. Imagine if on that day he had said to his friends, don't bother taking me to the pool. I give up. I give up. Don't bother taking me. I give up. This is never going to change. This is never going to be different. This situation will always be in my life. This disease will always be in my life. This challenge that I'm facing will always be in my life. I give up! It's always too soon to give up. It's always too soon to quit. I don't know what challenge you're facing today. I know that whenever, as we talked about in past weeks, whenever you have a group like this, there are many people facing challenges, many of which you don't know. I don't know. I don't know what you're facing. You may be facing an illness-related challenge. It's too soon to give up. It's too soon to give up hope. It's too soon to quit on Jesus. You may be facing a marriage-related challenge. You may be the person who is in the situation and you don't want your spouse to go, but they're determined to go. And don't, I want to tell you, don't give up. You may be the spouse that wants to leave. You may say, I'm getting nothing out of this. Other people are doing it, why shouldn't I? I want you to know it's always too soon to quit. It's always too soon to quit. Your challenge may be job-related. Family related, a circumstance in your life. Your challenge may be financial. I don't know what your challenge is today. I know some of your challenges, but not all of yours. I don't know what your challenge is, but it's always too soon to quit. It's always too soon to give up. That's what we see in this man's life. I can't even imagine what that 13,879 days was like. I can't imagine what it was like to get up every morning and know that that's my life. And wait for somebody with the goodness to carry you, to lay you beside a pool and hope that you'll see the waters stir and hope that there's some way you can get down into those healing waters. It's always too soon to give up. John chapter 5, last week we started this passage. Remember, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the feasts. We think it may have been Passover. We don't know. In Jerusalem, John explains, there is the outside the sheep gate or near the sheep gate, north of the temple, a pool covered by five covered colonnades there. A great number, verse 3 tells us, of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. It's a picture of the world that Jesus came to save. It's a picture of the spiritual condition of the world that Jesus came to save. So many people who need Him. Well, one who had been there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there, verse 6 tells us, and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" We looked at that question last week. I find it an interesting question. I find the answer even more interesting. Now put yourself in this guy's place. 38 years, you're lying there, and somebody stands before you and says, "Do you want to get well?" What's your answer? Yes, I want to get well. Are you kidding? Yes, I want to get well. That wasn't his answer. That wasn't his answer. Look at verse 7. "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." He didn't understand who stood in front of him. By the way, we're going to find out throughout this passage, he doesn't know who it was who healed him. He doesn't know it was Jesus. He's going to be questioned by the authorities. "Who is it that told you to take up your mat and walk? Who told you to do that?" He says, I don't know who the guy was. He was here 1 minute. The next minute he's in the crowd. But instead of yes, he says, I don't have anybody. You see, I have no strength. Perhaps he had lost his determination. I don't know. But he's still there by the pool, and you got to give him props for that. He was helpless and hopeless, and he doesn't know that hope is standing before him. "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water's stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." And then Jesus just turns to him, looks at him, and he issues three commands. Three commands by Jesus in this passage. "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." Now you'll notice there's a couple interesting things about this. Do you find any request for healing here? Nope, there's no request for healing. The man didn't say, "Well, please heal me." There's no request at all for healing. There's no expression of faith on the part of the man. None. As I said a moment ago, he didn't even know who it was who healed him. No request for healing, no expression of faith on the part of the man. We don't know. Maybe he had faith, maybe he didn't. All we know is that he responded to Jesus' words, and because he responded to Jesus' words, he was healed. That's what verse 9, the early part of verse 9 tells us. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and he walked. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and he walked. Now, it's interesting, Dr. J. Vernon McGee, who I dearly love, and I mentioned to him, to you from time to time, because he was so plain speaking. I love that. Never used $10 theological words to impress people with his great learning. He's just a plain speaking kind of country boy. I think he was from Texas. That's probably another reason I like him. I wasn't born here, but I got here as soon as I could. I like to tell Kathy, my wife, that. You know, those of you who don't know us, she was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. So I like to hear Vernon McGee. He said about Jesus' command to this man, he said Jesus made no provision for a relapse. Jesus made no provision for a relapse. He says to the man, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." Now, by the way, there's a lot more there than that, because by picking up his mat and walking with his mat, he would be violating what? The Sabbath. And there are a lot of people in that day who loved the law a lot more than they loved people. It wasn't the law of God that they loved more than people. It was the law of human tradition that they loved more than people. But there is no provision for a relapse here. Didn't need to be a provision for a relapse. When Jesus healed somebody, they were instantaneously cured, and they were cured forever. Now, it didn't mean they wouldn't die at some future time. But of that particular disease he cured them of, they were cured instantaneously. And in a moment, we're going to look at the characteristics of the healing that Jesus did. The characteristics of the healing that Jesus did. But what I want you to see from verse 8 and the first part of verse 9 is that the power to heal was in Jesus' word. The power to heal was in Jesus' word. He didn't do any theatrics. He just simply spoke to the man, said, "Get up, take up your mat, and walk." Now, I want you to think about this. I want you to think about how unbelievable a miracle this is. What happens to a person when they cannot walk? What happens to their muscles? They atrophy. They atrophy. You've got to keep physical therapy going on for any kind of muscle to be maintained. And even with physical therapy, it's hard to maintain muscle mass in a person, isn't it? Think of this man, 38 years, 38 years paralyzed, 38 years he can't walk. Think of what those muscles were like. And yet Jesus looks at him and says, "Get up, take up your mat, and walk." This is a magnificent miracle. It's an incredible miracle. At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. Do you get the picture? It's not like the guy's down in the ground and he goes, "Well, I'll get up. Oh, this is so hard." And then one foot goes up gingerly. And then the other foot gets up gingerly. That's the way I get out of a chair these days. Old age is upon me. But that's a whole other story, okay? Do you notice that? It didn't happen by degrees. It didn't happen a little at a time. You saw the muscle start to pop, 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 and then suddenly the guy's got a muscle and he can stand up. None of that, none of that. Get up, pick up your mat and walk. At once, the man was cured and he picked up his mat and he walked. He just simply responded to what a man told him because he didn't know it was Jesus. Now, I want to talk for a minute because I think this is important. There are a lot of people who claim to be able to heal today. You see them on TV. You hear about them all the time. They claim to have the gift of healing and they can go about healing people, usually in a TV studio or in a municipal auditorium or a stadium these days because a lot of people want to come out for that kind of thing. And from the hours of 7 to 8:30, they'll heal you. And so we see a lot of that. You see a lot of them on TV, and you see a lot of theatrics, and you see a lot of that sort of thing, and you ask yourself, well, is this real? Is it true? Now, by the way, that's a whole study in itself, and it would be fascinating. It'd be fascinating to get into that. I just want to touch on some themes this morning. Six characteristics of Jesus' healing. Now, I want to share with you where they come from. They come from an author by the name of John MacArthur. I know that a lot of you know him. Great teacher of the Word of God. He got a little messed up on Lordship Salvation, and you and I can talk about that another time. I won't get into that this morning, but great teacher of the Word of God. And he wrote a book years ago called The Charismatics, A Doctrinal Perspective. And in that book, he dealt with things like speaking in tongues. What does the Bible have to say about speaking in tongues? What does it have to say about healing and faith healers? What does it have to say about miraculous things, miracles? And the book is called The Charismatics, A Doctrinal Perspective. A few years ago, well, more than a few years ago now, he updated the book and retitled it, and it's now called Charismatic Chaos. Charismatic Chaos. It's a great book. I recommend it to you highly. And I just want to share from one of his chapters on healing where he talks about the characteristics of not only Jesus' healing, but the characteristics then of the apostles' healing, because they did the same kind of healing Jesus did. They did the same kind of healing Jesus did. They healed disease. They raised, Peter and Paul especially, raised people from the dead. And so the characteristics of Jesus' healing and also the apostles' healing. There are six of them. Let me go through them. And again, I want you to know I'm sharing with you from John MacArthur. All right. Now I'll be quoting some from him, and I'll tell you when the quotes are, so you know what his words are and what my words are. The first characteristics of Jesus' healing is he healed with a word or a touch. That's what we see here, don't we? He didn't do anything, no theatrics, no nothing. He just said to the man, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. So Jesus healed. One of the characteristics of Jesus' healing and that of the apostles is they healed with a word or a touch. No theatrics, no special environments. The apostles just simply spoke. Sometimes touched. Sometimes Jesus healed because somebody touched his robe. Remember the woman who had the issue of blood was healed just by touching his robe. Jesus healed with a word or a touch. We saw that at the end of chapter 4 where Jesus healed the royal official's son who came the 20 or 25 miles from Capernaum to see Jesus in Cana so that his son who was near death's door could be healed. And Jesus said, go home, your son's healed. So he healed with a word or a touch. I want to give you another example of that. Back in Matthew chapter 8, if you don't mind, turn there to Matthew. First book of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8, starting at verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. Jesus said to him, I will go and heal him. The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished. Now I'm going to cut to the chase, verse 13. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, it will be done just as you believed it was, and his servant was healed at that very hour. Again, we see Jesus healing by his word over long distance. So the first characteristic of Jesus healing and that of the apostles' healing is that Jesus healed with a word or a touch. Second characteristic of Jesus' healing is that he healed instantly. He healed instantly. He did not do what MacArthur calls progressive healing. Let me share with you from MacArthur. He said this, Jesus never did progressive healing. If Jesus had not healed instantly. Now, this is a great point, and I want you to get it, so please listen carefully to his words. If Jesus had not healed instantly, there would have been no miraculous element sufficient to demonstrate his deity. If Jesus had not healed instantly, there would have been no miraculous element sufficient to demonstrate his deity. His critics, MacArthur says, could easily have said the healing was just a natural process. But Jesus didn't give them that opportunity because he healed instantaneously. That's what's happening here in our passage. Jesus says to the man, get up, pick up your mat and walk. And what do we read in verse 9? At once, instantaneously, the man was cured. By the way, that makes allowance. And I understand you might come later and say, well, a couple of times Jesus did his healing in stages. Well, there were a couple of instances where he healed in two phases. But that's different from progressive healing because the healing ultimately was done instantaneously. The third characteristic. First of all, Jesus healed with a word or a touch. Secondly, Jesus healed instantaneously. Thirdly, Jesus healed totally. Jesus healed totally. There was no recuperation period necessary. Jesus healed totally. Do you remember one day Mark describes this in his gospel? Jesus came to the home of Simon Peter, and his mother-in-law, and it's kind of funny that he has a mother-in-law since some religions say he never married. It's hard to get a mother-in-law if you're not married, okay? That's a whole other story. Anyhow, his mother-in-law was sick with a fever. What did Jesus do? He healed her. Yeah, that's what we're talking about, healing. So it's that was an easy question, okay? just by deduction. He healed her. What happened after that? She made dinner. She got up and started to serve them. She was healed, bam, instantaneously and totally. And totally. No recuperation period was necessary. It was so unlike so many healers today who tell you claim the healing by faith while the symptoms go on. Just claim it by faith. You're healed. Never mind, you're still in the wheelchair. Claim by faith that you're healed. Never mind, you still have the fever. Claim by faith that you're healed. This guy never even showed any faith in John chapter 5, did he? He didn't even know who healed him. Jesus healed with a word or a touch. Jesus healed instantaneously. Jesus healed totally. Number 4, Jesus healed everybody. Jesus healed everybody. Once again, I'd like to quote from MacArthur. Unlike healers today, Jesus did not leave long lines of disappointed people who had to return home in their wheelchairs. He did not have healing services or programs that ended at a certain time because of airline or television schedules. Luke 4:40 tells us, "And while the sun was setting, all who had any sick with various diseases brought them to him, and laying his hands on every one of them, he was healing them." How many of them did he lay his hands on and heal? Every one of them. Every one of them. He didn't stop when the camera went off. He healed everybody. He healed everybody. By the way, next week we'll have a little bit to say about healing today and faith healers. So hang on to that. Next week we'll talk about that a little bit. All right, we have Jesus healed with a word or a touch, number 1. Number 2, Jesus healed instantaneously. Number 3, Jesus healed totally. Number 4, Jesus healed everybody. And now number 5, Jesus healed organic disease. Jesus healed organic disease. Now what do I mean by that? Well, there are 3 kinds of diseases. There is functional disease. That could be illustrated by a sore arm. A sore arm is a functional disease. Nothing's wrong with my arm. A couple of years ago, I had severe pain all winter long in this shoulder I couldn't put my arm in a coat. It hurt so bad. It was sore. But there's nothing wrong with my arm. Muscles were okay. Well, what muscles I have were okay. Nothing wrong with my arm. It's something in there caused pain. That's functional disease. There is organic disease. That would be illustrated by a withered arm or no arm at all. That's organic disease. That's the kind of healing that Jesus did. The organ is organically destroyed or it's maimed or crippled. Those kinds of things are organic disease. Organic disease. Deformities would be an example of an organic disease. That's the kind of healing Jesus did. He healed organic disease. The third category of disease is psychogenic disease, and that was illustrated by you think your arm is sore, but it isn't really. Okay? That doesn't mean that the person who thinks their arm is sore doesn't, in their mind, feel real pain, but it's in their mind. Okay? So there's functional disease, there is organic disease, there is psychogenic disease. Most of what you see healers do today is either functional or psychogenic. Functional or psychogenic, not organic. Disease. MacArthur says this, Jesus did not go up and down Palestine healing lower back pain, heart palpitations, headaches, and other invisible ailments. He healed the most obvious kinds of organic disease, crippled legs, withered hands, blind eyes, palsy, all healings that were undeniably miraculous. That's the kind of healing Jesus did. The sixth thing. First thing is that Jesus healed with a word or a touch. Number 2, Jesus healed instantaneously. Number 3, Jesus healed totally. Number 4, Jesus healed everybody. Number 5, Jesus healed organic disease. And finally, number 6, Jesus raised the dead. Jesus raised the dead. Again, quoting MacArthur, Luke 7 tells us that while Jesus was at a city called Nain, he came upon a funeral procession as a widow went out to bury her only son. Jesus stopped the procession, touched the coffin, and said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. He also raised the synagogue ruler's daughter in Mark chapter 5. And then MacArthur, I think, astutely says this, "People who tout the gift of healing today do not spend much time in funeral parlors, funeral processions, or cemeteries. The reason is obvious. The reason is obvious." All right, Jesus healed with a word or a touch. He healed instantaneously. He healed totally. He healed everybody. He healed organic disease, and he raised the dead. That was characteristic of his healing. It was also characteristic of the healings that the apostles did, because the reason that we see them healing, the reason we see them doing that, for instance, in the book of Acts, is because people would look at them and be reminded of the person they were preaching, Jesus Christ. They did the same things he did. Jesus tells the man back in John chapter 5, verse 8, get up, pick up your mat and walk. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. And then John tells us the day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "Wow, we're ecstatic that after 38 years you can walk and carry your mat." Is that what your text says? If so, then you have an errant Bible. No, what it says is, "And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'It's the Sabbath day. The law forbids you to carry your mat.'" Seriously? 38 years. Don't you understand? 38 years. You see this mat? That's my home for 38 years. Now all of a sudden I'm carrying it and walking. And all you can see is it was done on the wrong day of the week. Now, by the way, the truth of it is here that Jesus, I think, purposely healed on the Sabbath because he was beginning to challenge the religious authorities of that day. This healing would certainly do that. He was becoming more public about who he was in his ministry. But Jesus is always also trying to challenge something else. And it isn't the law of Moses that this man was violating by carrying his mat on that Sabbath day. It was human tradition that he was violating. It was empty, as one writer called it, empty ritualism that this man was violating. You see, what the Jews did is they took the law which simply said, "Thou shalt not do any work on the Sabbath." Pretty simple, right? Well, they said, well, I guess then the first question is, what's work? And so they came up with a list of 39 father works, they called them. Really interesting term. 39 father works. The law said do not work on the Sabbath. They came up with 39 things that were father works on the Sabbath. And then they attached to those father works what they called descendant works. Under each of those 39, they had another whole group of descendant works that came out of those 39. They come out of that one simple command, do not work on the Sabbath. Let me illustrate by sharing from one of the writers who said this: "There were restrictions laid down in the Mosaic law, but the rabbis had elaborated from these a vast array of injunctions and prohibitions, making of the Sabbath law a veritable bondage. Moses said, 'Thou shalt not do any work.' The rabbis made out a system of 39 works, which done rendered the offender subject to death by stoning." They took that one thing, made it into 39 things that you could be stoned for doing on the Sabbath. The writer goes on to say this: "Derived from these father works were numerous descendant works. One of the father works was plowing. A son of this was digging." And I'm going to give you more background about that. No, right? So a father work was you could not plow. Plowing was violating the Sabbath law. And then a descendant work is you couldn't dig. All right? I'll elaborate on that. I'll share with from this writer and elaborate. "Wearing false teeth was a descendant of carrying a burden." Yeah. You can't make this stuff up, folks. I'm reading this scholar, okay, who studied this. That reminds me of a cartoon I saw. Excuse me. Don't let me get too far off the track. But a cartoon, I love cartoons. I love good jokes, you know. I just love those sort of things. And this cartoon shows this preacher standing up on a pulpit, and he has a handful of papers, and he's waving them, and he said, "These are not my thoughts. These are the thoughts of a man who knows what he's talking about." So these are not my thoughts. These are the thoughts of a man who knows what he's talking about. Okay. "Among the descendants of reaping were the plucking of a head of wheat or the pulling out of a gray hair from one's head." That was reaping. "Lengthy rules were formulated," the writer goes on, "about what kind of knots one might tie on the Sabbath. The camel driver's knot, the sailor's knots were not to be tied or untied on the Sabbath day. Other kind of knots could be, not those two, because those knots were work. Okay? This is the one, I just love this one. Two letters of the alphabet might not be written together. I mean, if you write two letters of the alphabet together, you've made a word. That's work. You can't do that. To kindle or extinguish a fire was a great desecration, not even justified in the case of emergency or sickness. And the writer says this, the Sabbath had become a grievous burden by the thousands of such restrictions and rules too numerous to mention. And then he elaborates a little bit. Let me just, these are too good. I can't just pass over this, okay? And I got a few more minutes today, okay? Thus, the writer says, plowing was one of the 39, and under it was classed digging. And digging included much. For example, it was forbidden to draw a chair along the ground, lest it should make a rut. Let me try to say that again, okay? You couldn't take a chair and drag it along the ground because it would make a rut in the ground. That was digging, and that violated plowing. I'm not making it up. And though it was permissible to spit on a pavement, I love this one. It was permissible to spit on the pavement and rub the expectoration. Don't you love that word? And rub the spit with your foot. It was debated whether it was permissible to perform the same operation on the earth for as much as the foot would scratch the surface. So you could spit on a pavement and you could wipe out the spit, but you couldn't spit on the ground and do that because you would be doing what? Digging, which means you would be plowing. One last one. A woman must not look into her mirror on the Sabbath day, lest she should discover a gray hair and be tempted to pluck it out. This would be classified as reaping. Here's the headline, the bottom line, whatever line you want. Here it is. This man for 38 years could not move off his mat, paralyzed, desperate for somebody to come along who could help him. I don't know how much hopelessness he felt or how much helplessness he felt. I would tend to think it would be a lot, but he didn't quit having somebody take him to the pool. He was in that situation 13,879 days. What I want to end with this morning is to challenge you and to challenge myself. As I said at the beginning, I don't know what you're facing, but it's too soon to quit. I don't know what you're facing, but it's too soon to give up, because there's always Jesus. And He can handle the challenges, whatever they are, of your life and my life.